servant hearing, Ms. Baker Galloway.
Hello.
The Albertown property owners.
Yes.
At this point in the afternoon.
Yes. Yesterday.
Yes. And so, how would you like to proceed?
So I apologise for the late provision of my legal submission. So it's my first question is, I won't assume you had time to read them. Have you had time to read them?
I have. So are you unanimous? Yes. Yes, Mrs. Baker Galloway,
I've had an
attempt
very late,
but I
understand
so I think
it wasn't making a lot of
sense. No, it's late in the day,
it's
fair enough.
Okay, so I think you better take us
I'll
through.
I'll take you through them, yeah.
Probably. Yes. Use your discretion.
Yes, I will. I will start from paragraph 4. And so I've sort of tracked the evolution of the identification of the ONF in the vicinity of Whitlow Terrace. Started off on planning map 24B, indicated the boundary of the ONF to align with the Clutha River and exclude the unformed legal road of Whitlow Terrace. That roughly follows the landscape boundaries as indicated in Dr. Reed's original landscape boundaries report from 2014 in Ms. Stevens' peer review of that report. And then there was Mr. Cutler's submission, which requested that the Whitlow Terrace ONF be amended and brought up the bank so as to include the adjacent river bank as part of the outstanding natural river corridor. What then occurred was Ms. Melsop's evidence lodged in support of this hearing stream, accepting the submission from Mr. Cutler and recommending the boundary of the Whitlow Terrace ONF to be amended to follow the landward legal boundary of Whitlow Terrace. Mr. Barr's 42A report accepts that recommendation and had no further analysis. And then Ms. Melsop's rebuttal evidence lodged re-examines the ONF boundary and acknowledges her evidence and chief boundary does not accurately follow the top of the river escarpment and therefore amends the boundary further north towards the notified boundary location. Mr. Barr's rebuttal evidence then relies on Ms. Melsop's refined boundary. So what I do here is just take you through the key concerns we have with the evidence presented in the 42A round in support of the amended boundary. Ms. Melsop's evidence in chief considers Mr. Cutler's requested amended ONF boundary, and the critical issue that we have with this analysis is that it is not in accordance with her stated methodology, with the exception of A, referring to the ODP rather than the PDP. As you set out there, a quote. I'll let you read to yourselves.
What you quoted are the landscape tests for identification of O&Ls and vowels. Are O&Ls the same tests?
Well, no, but I don't think there's actually any guidance as to the specific test for an O&F. So this is the best, because if an O&F is a feature rather than the broader landscape, so it's can be a subset of a landscape, then it is a landscape related assessment, my understanding.
Thank you.
Then I go on in 6 to say Ms. Melsop's more detailed analysis of the Whitlow Terrace ONF does not, however, employ the methodology she cites, and rather it focuses on the following key points. Reference to the notified PDP maps being an error in translation from a marker pen on an aerial to a precise GIS. The amended boundary is consistent with other areas of the Clutha River ONF and includes riverbanks and terrace faces that form an integral part of the feature. That the escarpment is clearly legible and, whilst potentially partially modified, is connected to other unmodified riverbank landforms. and that the ONF in this location will not compromise future stability works if needed, but would ensure such works minimise adverse effects on the natural character of the Clutha River. And I refer to each of the above points now. The purported error in defining the Wicklow Terrace ONF boundary on the map is not supported in her evidence with reference to what aerial map this error came from, or whether this is in fact the case. There's no evidential basis for this claim. Moreover, as provided in the evidence of Mr Grant, upon close inspection of Dr Reed's landscape report, figure 29, it appears as though the boundary line is drawn very precisely to follow the river and exclude most of the legal road portion of Wicklow Terrace.
Just pause there, Ms Baker, can I? I've read Mr Grant's evidence, of course, and again, you've highlighted, is it a mistake or is it? Does it matter? There's clearly jurisdiction.
There's jurisdiction.
Subject to your argument about whether what the underlying zoning is and whether you put an O and L on, but if that can be surmounted, there's clearly jurisdiction to shift the O and F line.
Yep.
So, as I say, is this just a red herring? We've got to make a decision and recommendation to council based on the evidence before us.
Yes.
Should we care?
Should we care? Whether or not that was a mistake?
Yeah.
You should care because the subsequent analysis, there's a disconnect between that. It's not the major issue. You have to turn your mind to whether or not it was a mistake.
You
need to evaluate it on its merits, and we're not arguing that there's no jurisdiction. Dr. Reed also rebuts the issues raised by Mr. Grant, stating that her original map showed land between the river and the line and between the line and the property boundaries. It's unfortunate that figure 29 is of such poor quality in the initial report. However, we've viewed it on screen and zoomed in, and on that basis it's clear that the line touches the river. Furthermore, the explanation that in general the Clutha ONF has been defined by reference to at least the lowest of the enclosing terrace features is also ambiguous. And when you see the photos produced in Mr. Grant's summary, and I assume that you will be doing a site visit, is that a dangerous assumption to make?
No, we already have.
Great. All right, so Mr. Grant's, just for the record, Mr. Grant's photos, he's not appearing as an expert, so they're really just a reference point. He hasn't taken them as a landscape expert or anything like that. They are simply photos that may be useful for your reference in combination with what you've gleaned yourselves on your site visit.
And the photos I took.
And the photos you took,
for the same purpose.
Great, there we go. When looking at the photos in Mr. Grant's summary, the lowest enclosing terrace could easily be discerned in my submission as the terrace of the lower walkway down to the water margin. Ms. Melsop's reference to consistency with other areas of the Clutha River ONF is not clear in stating what those other areas are or where. It is also not clear how the Wicklow terraces and riverbank are assumed to be integral to the Clutha River ONF when the values and characteristics of that feature are not identified. Conversely, I submit that it's not appropriate to define one landscape classification boundary by comparing other parts of the same feature and assuming the boundary follows the same course.
Can I test that?
Yes.
If you took a different reference point on the opposite side of the river, wouldn't you have a reasonable case that the landscape architects have been inconsistent? That consistency in this regard would be a virtue rather than something than a flaw in logic.
We've only looked at with a microscope at this site. As you know, we're not calling expert evidence, we're just testing the evidence that's otherwise before you. So without that basis, that consistency argument only goes so far.
Please go on.
This is inconsistent with the WESI criteria requiring a factual assessment on the ground. It is also not explained in evidence as to how the banks and terraces are an integral part of the feature, or by example clarifying the formative processes of that feature and the surrounding landscape. And there I just draw your attention back to the third appendix of Mr. Grant's evidence in chief, which is simply the record from the, I think it's over two years ago, Queensland Lakes website of the flooding line that corresponds with the, you know, more with the riverside boundary of Whitlow Terrace rather than the uphill side, in terms of the interplay of natural processes and the terraces. Similar to the submission above, the consideration of the escarpment being connected to other unmodified riverbank forms is problematic. It is unclear where this connection is or what other unmodified riverbank forms are being referred to. As provided in the evidence of Mr. Grant, the Whitlow Terrace banks are subject to erosion and have been modified to a large extent over time. As above, it's also questionable the extent to which outstandingness of a part of a feature can be existing by way of association only from another part of that feature. The witness does acknowledge that the bank is at least partially modified, yet in her rebuttal does not refer to modification or naturalness in refining the boundary to follow the top of the escarpment rather than the cadastral boundaries. Conversely, it seems unusual that Dr. Reeves' rebuttal considers the upper surface of the River Terrace has been modified and domesticated and is strongly influenced in its character and quality by the adjacent dwellings, but does not analyse the modification on the face of the terrace feature itself, nor the walkway below. And again, I refer you back to those photos in your own experience. Then, because I know that we don't have that much time and I don't want to waste it all with you listening to me, I'd rather have questions for Mr. Grant also. I'll move to paragraph 11 and touch briefly on the planning evidence. So paragraph 12, the amendment of the boundary is only referred to in the strategic overview report from Mr. Barr, however is not analysed more closely within the specific rezoning reports, and Mr. Barr's rebuttal does however look at the issue more closely. Mr. Barr relies on the refined boundary proffered in the rebuttal evidence from Ms. Melsop, the only planning reason for which is in his paragraph 28.8, where he states that it would be logical and feasible to include the road within a landscape classification up to where it joins an urban zoning. With respect, council cannot follow the logic of that reasoning. Mr. Barr then goes on to consider the underlying zoning of the road and its relevance to landscape categorisation. Mr. Barr considers that all roads in the district are not allocated in underlying zoning. Therefore, rules do not apply and there are no rules which control development on roads. The following issues arise from that. Whilst roads and formed roads are defined in the PDP, unformed roads are not, and therefore it is uncertain whether these fall to be considered within an adjacent zone. The Environment Court in South and Fish and Game and South and District Council found that council's voting powers under the Local Government Act were subject to the RMA, and therefore any rule in district and regional plans, due to the permissive nature of the LGA voting powers as compared to the restrictive nature of the RMA in particular. Given Whitlow Terrace is an unformed road, it is not unimaginable that in the future, as in the case of South and Fish and Game, consents might be sought for development to be undertaken within the road reserve, in which council or other persons might wish to ensure the effects of were regulated by the RMA. Do you have some questions?
In that regard, I've just turned up the definition, and the definition of PDP hopefully tells me that a road is a road as defined in the LGA.
Mm.
What's the LGA definition?
Oh, I don't know that off the top of my head. But I can find out for you.
I think I can. If you can't tell me, I'll look it up. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Keep going.
I refer to the evidence of Mr. Grant, which considers only classification over zones other than those zoned rural. It is submitted that there is a discrepancy in the reasoning between Mr. Barr's evidence in chief relating to landscape boundaries and classifications on land other than rural, and Mr. Barr's rebuttal, which considers that roads without zoning may be categories within an O&L. Mr. Barr's evidence in chief clearly acknowledges that the framework of the PDP primarily provides for the O&L and O&S classifications within the rural zone, and that the rules and assessment matters relating to the three landscape classification overlays are in the rural zone. Although Mr. Grant's evidence refers to the amended ONF boundary as now covering the township zone rather than the legal road of Whitlow Terrace, I consider this analysis to still be correct and helpful to the Commission. The reasoning from Mr. Barr's section 20 is equally applicable to legal roads as well as zones other than rural zones. There is no justification to include this portion of the legal road within the ODF boundary.
It's the bottom line that the, whatever the road is, it's not on, in the rural zone?
Well, that seems to be the council's position, yes.
And is that your position? That if it's, and in the, and the second leg is that only O&L's boundaries can only be in the rural zone?
No, that's not. No, I don't think the plan says that they can only be in the rural zone. I agree that they can be outside of the rural zone, but it's the opposite really. In the rural zone, there must be a landscape classification. That's the starting point. So all of the rural zone will have a landscape classification over it. But there may be, you know, bits of O&H and bits of O&Ls that extend beyond the rural zone. Legally, yeah.
Questions?
Yes, I'll introduce Mr. Grant. So I have extra copies if they're needed by anybody of the summary and my legal submissions. If you just start reading from paragraph 3.
Good afternoon. My evidence addresses the following matters. The relevance of the township zone and the existing development in determining the boundary of the Clutha River ONF. B. The relevance of the legal road at Whitway Terrace in determining the boundary of the ONF. C. Bank instability in the area identified in the Clutha River ONF extension. The relevance of the flood limits for the Clutha River in determining the boundary of the Clutha River ONF. Bank instability. The terrace referred to by Mr. Cutler at this locality is not natural, having been engineered to some degree in response to land instability. These issues are potentially ongoing and further works may be required in the future. The GeoSol Limited report appended to my rebuttal evidence clearly evidences the fact that there are multiple areas along the banks of the river which may present a hazard of bank instability in the future. An ONF stated in these areas could make necessary works potentially more difficult in the future. Ms. Millsop has not considered the formative process of the area of the river terraces, as evidenced in paragraph 8119 of her evidence in chief, by stating the river escarpment in this location is likely to have been at least partially modified. I understand these terraces to have been modified to a large extent in the past through multiple bank stability works. Flood limits. I provided the flood limits from the QLDC hazards database with my evidence to show the extent of the river margins in flood to the extent that it is relevant to determining the extent of the ONF boundary. And to help, and what's already been discussed, I've attached to the summary a number of photos of the escarpment which exhibit the modified nature of the area, and you've already seen that yourselves. I hope that these will assist the commissioners to understand from a lay person's perspective why the notified PDP landscape lines make the most sense on the ground, as well as from a practical point of view. Thank you.
One question. You've referred to the modifications as one of the sort of justifications for where the ONF line should be. So what I'd like to understand is whether, from your knowledge of the wider area, do similar modifications occur elsewhere along the riverbank?
I can't really answer that from my knowledge, but I know there is a specific situation that exists at Albertown, primarily because you've got a bunch of houses sitting on top of land that has historically been unstable. I don't know whether that situation exists elsewhere, I presume it does. just logically, in the way the landforms have been created.
In that situation, do you know whether there is an ONS line?
Elsewhere?
Over the modified area that you're talking about.
Sorry, I don't quite understand.
Well, you're saying that this riverbank is modified. I was wondering if there were other situations where the riverbank has also been modified where there is an ONS line.
I don't know the answer to that. Elsewhere, those natural processes would, in the rural situation, they would be left to carry on. They wouldn't have had the money that was spent on this situation to retain the bank, which is due to the fact that it's adjacent to a township.
In terms of your logic, Mr. Grant, is it the fact that it's a road or that it's modified? It wouldn't matter what it was that you were focused on.
From my perspective as a surveyor, I think you've got a unique situation here because you've got a township sitting right on the edge of the river. I don't know that occurs anywhere else, not locally anyway. I think that's what the ownership of the land, I think it's more a practical situation, and that's what I thought when I saw the original line, that someone has actually sat down and thought this through and logically put it against the river rather than on the terrace, because the terrace isn't natural in this location. I think whether it's road or whether it was something else is largely secondary.
Thank you for that. Commissioner Clare? Any more for any more team? All good.
Right.
Thank you
very much. I guess same question in respect of legal submissions. If you've had whether or not you've had a chance to read them, or how much detail this is. As you know, is it 40 minutes?
Or 3:10.
Okay, so we don't have to be too much of a rush.
I think we're all good on the submission front,
right.
And so you can assume that we've read them.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to highlight?
Yeah, I will.
And the other thing for you is, I realise and appreciate that this is an opening shot, and we might get rather more next week, but you're providing us with a framework against which we can consider the two witnesses.
That's right.
Who we're hearing today.
Yeah.
So I have about three questions of clarification that are more about so I understand better when I, the background when I reread your evidence for next week.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm open to how you want to proceed, whether you want to take us through these submissions, whether it's taken as read, given that you have read.
Yeah, what I'll do is I will only take you through the points that are actually specific to Dr. Robert Lindsay and Mr. McRae. So that's all, starting from page 6. I'll just take you through the ecological benefits and diversification. And so, and then the everything up front is really setting the scene for the bigger picture. And so I'll to the extent I need to, I'll take you through that in more detail when we have a full day together next week.
I can hardly wait.
So I'll start from paragraph 18. Positive ecological benefits. So, and I understand you had a conversation with Mr. Goldsmith yesterday on this similar point. And you,
a lengthy conversation. Yeah.
So I'll just sort of make the point, I don't need to repeat it. I
suspiciously like
the same language. Yes, I have the same position as Mr. Goldsmith, which is submitting that positive effects and positive environmental outcomes are a relevant matter for your consideration. So that's really paragraph 18 and paragraph 19. In 20, I submit that this proposal is consistent with taking those positive environmental effects into account, as they did, or as they did as an office comment in the Infinity case, as they stated in the Infinity case, that this is open to a decision maker to do in a planning context. I think, given that's a fundamental point to the whole case, you may have some questions for me today, but I suggest that we traverse that in more detail next week when Mr. Ferguson is here as well, because I think to the extent that those positive effects are secured in the planning provisions, and therefore the weight that you can give to them, that hinges on the strength of his evidence also.
Well, no doubt Mr. Goldsmith and Ms. Hill reported to you the questions I posed to them and the request I made for more assistance.
Yeah.
And Mr. Goldsmith, in his inimitable style, negotiated until 14th to respond in writing.
Yeah.
I'd welcome the chance to discuss it with you next week,
yeah.
But I'd settle now that, having given Mr. Goldsmith that opportunity, I'd give that one back to you too, because I think it is central to the case you're advancing.
Yeah, it is. It is part of the package. Yeah.
Like, we can't consider the package. We might have difficulty accepting the product.
That's right, yeah. So I think I'll take that offer. But to the extent I can, between now, I'll obviously try and file part two of my legal submissions better than the night before, so that you have a bit more time to digest them before next Thursday.
And hopefully they're shorter than Mr. Goldsmith's as well.
Yeah, I'm sure they will definitely be shorter than Mr. Goldsmith. I'm guaranteeing that. Very much last words.
Could you just take a step back a little bit and just clarify for me what relationship there is between the previous consents and the current submission?
The current proposal, the current proposed zone, what relationship?
What is the relevance of that consent?
The relevance of the consent?
I know you intended to talk about what's the existing environment next time.
Yes.
Are those consents being relied on?
Yes, no, they are being given effect to. So the 22,000 plants have been planted.
No, not quite. I don't think that's quite the question. Are you running an existing environment position?
Based on the...
Yeah.
A Hawthorne-type position based on the consents?
Yes.
So if you are, aren't the positive effects you're telling us about already in the environment by virtue of the consents?
Yes, they are.
So you're double dipping them?
No, I wouldn't say we're double dipping them. They are a part of the existing environment.
So why would we consider them positive effects arising from the relief you seek if we're being told we're already going to be in the environment anyway?
Because we're proposing a wider...
Right, so they're additional.
zone that...
Exactly. So I wasn't clear in my head what the difference or net additional positives might be. It seems to me that I was being sold something that's already been consented.
No, we're not trying to do that. We're trying to give you something that's exactly as consented and then a little bit more. Exactly. Yeah. So it's a little bit more, but additionally positive. But then if the zone as a whole was relied on to move forward instead of the consent, which you'll hear why this is being proffered as a package, those positive benefits are still still intended to be required.
Not taken out.
Yeah. No. Right. Clear?
Thanks for that.
While swinging with it,
yep.
The question I was going to have is your proposal that if you are successful and you get the zone permissions you want, you'll surrender the consent?
That's not been discussed. No, I don't understand that that's the proposal, but I can have a proper answer for you next week on that.
Because one of the, that would seem to be reasonably material, because to the extent that council staff have identified that your zone provisions are not on all fours with the consent conditions. If the consents remain, you'll still be bound by those conditions.
Mm.
Similarly, if the consents are surrendered, then it becomes very relevant the extent to which there is a difference.
Yes. Okay, all right.
And the second question, related, I understand you've already subdivided the land, or had undertaken the initial subdivision.
Yeah.
Can I assume that the covenants that are required in terms of the resource consent conditions are now all on the titles?
Yes, they are.
And the follow-up to that is, to the extent that the areas have changed, is there a mismatch between the covenants and the zones that you're now seeking?
We don't consider that there are, that there is a mismatch. So the covenants, so I think the mismatch you're talking about is that moraine slope hatching, which, is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm actually talking about the one that's most obvious to me is the lakeshore. You effectively shifted the lakeshore's area sideways.
Yeah.
The covenants over the old area,
yep.
So you've got a covenant over an area that you now no longer prefer pursuing,
yep.
And you haven't got a covenant over the new bit,
right,
of Lakeshore. In fact, I think you've got a different covenant, because that was formerly in the golf course.
Yes. Okay.
So those are.
That's where you want some clarification.
Following up on Commissioner Monroe's point,
okay.
The interrelationship between consent and zoning provisions.
Right.
And related, because the covenants now sit as instruments in their own right, independent of the consent.
Yes, exactly. So this is, I mean, you know, in that sense, it is actually a belts and braces position as far as those where we've tried to have plan provisions that have largely the same effect as the covenants, because you've still got the covenants. But it's because this is a very forward, you'll get this theme from Mr. McRae, it's a very forward-looking proposal. We're not just talking about the next 10 years. This is actually this, you know, part of the proposal was this family planning for its like 20-year intergenerational plan. So we're looking, and as you know, some of those covenants are quite time-bound. They've actually got quite a short period that some of the restrictions run for. So it's looking beyond the expiry of those to how, you know, what this farm in particular looks like 20 years from now. If you having an element of certainty about that and what's appropriate.
I haven't interrupted you. I'll put on the table the point that occurred to me arising out of your summary of the GPT's position on ecology, and Dr. Roper Lindsay runs with this position, in effect saying, we've already got a hot, like this is paraphrasing her evidence, but this is what I took from
it. Yep.
and she can tell me if I've got a problem in due course, that there are no ecological effects from the extensions, in effect, extending the golf course, shifting the LS area, the campground and the farm homestead area. Most of it's in grass, although Dr. Lloyd did tell me that grass is a valuable ecological resource yesterday. But putting that potential aside,
yeah.
The thought that occurred to me is that the logic of the consent decision was that the court was satisfied that the balance of advantage and disadvantage favoured the grant of consent.
Yes.
And because if it wasn't satisfied, it wouldn't have granted it. If you go to add extra areas and add extra effects, don't you have to add a few more positive effects along the way?
Well, but
to keep a positive balance.
Yes. No, and again, this is Mr. Ferguson answer as well. And particularly in terms of the actual effects of potential campgrounds and potential small development in the farm homestead area in particular, those effects, as I understand it, particularly in terms of landscape, because that's really the only potential one, have been assessed as being quite appropriate and acceptable. As you noted, it's grass, and so Dr. Lindsay will tell you what the ecological effects of developing grasses. So and then at the end of the day, the rule framework for those two areas in particular is a restricted discretionary status. There's not that same immediacy of you've got this development right. And there's not the same scale of effects that would ever justify quite big step of environmental compensation in those areas. So it's quite a different kettle of fish in that sense.
Well, I'll think about that. Please keep going.
Yeah, very good. So paragraph 21 is where I'll pick up from. As considered in Dr. Lindsay's evidence, it is necessary that the zone proposal requires extensive revegetation and restoration of ecological values that will not otherwise be promoted by existing historical agricultural activities on the land, particularly if it is necessary for these to be intensified to retain economic viability. Dr. Roper Lindsay supports the zoning provisions that ensure particular outcomes, and beyond that enable and provide incentive for a wider approach to ecological management that would go above and beyond the consent requirements. I submit that the ecological experts are not far apart in terms of their views on the appropriate provisions of the zone, and I defer to, Dr. Roper Lindsay's summary evidence to explain those remaining areas where clarification is required. Council evidence has explored whether explicit requirements for an extension of the revegetation strategy over additional land is justified. In response, Dr. Roper Lindsay notes that the areas for camping and farm homestead have low ecological values, and therefore the limited development anticipated for these areas has no corresponding adverse effect that would justify a requirement for the extension of the revegetation strategy. However, the combination of the policy support and policies 44316 and 44318 and rules 4455 and 4456, giving explicit discretion for enhancement of biodiversity values through additional planting in these two areas, means there is already a framework in place that would enable enhancements of indigenous biodiversity values in these two areas specifically. The anticipated results are ecological benefits over and above what are required by the current consent or contemplated in the rural general zone. On the topic of the farm vegetation and management areas, I'm just going to flip through so I've got structure plan in front of me as well. In the submission lodged, the structure plan identified the southern tributary and moraine slope landscape protection areas and Glendur Hill wetland landscape protection areas, which all sit within covenant areas G and F and the conditions of consent in the Environment Court decision. And I just attached that so that you didn't have to flip through all the evidence to find it again. So that's Appendix A to my legal submissions, is the the map from the court of the general covenant areas. And then I've attached as B two plans from the court decision that show where the moraine slope and gullies and wetlands specifically were identified, the specific location of them. So that's the second two plans in my legal submissions. So the current consent conditions require the preparation and implementation of a revegetation strategy, which is very, very detailed set of requirements, requires the control of stock access, specific fencing requirements, pest management requirements, and revegetation for these hatched areas in particular. And the purpose of the consent conditions is primarily to control farm management and protect ecological values, not specifically landscape qualities. So the name, we've renamed it so that it's a more relevant name to farm and vegetation management areas on the structure plan. And then Dr. Roper Lindsay's evidence addresses the rules as they relate to revegetation and fencing in particular of these areas. And rule 44.5.4 is intended to reflect the requirements of the conditions for the hatched areas from consent. The boundary of the hatched area on Plan B, as it relates to the moraine slope, has been amended. So if you look at Plan B, you'll see in the bottom right corner, there's an L-shaped, or an L on its side-shaped hatched area. Anybody got that? Good, good, good. And then, if you did compare that to the structure plan, you'll see it's there as well, but it's got a slightly different shape on its upper limb. So that has been specifically amended after ground truthing the lines previously applied by the Environment Court. Once the Environment Court lines were translated onto the ground, it was found that they extended beyond the moraine slope itself and onto the flat grazed area adjoining the fern burn that is not sloped, is grazed, and does not express the biodiversity values sought to be protected. And this matter is addressed briefly by Dr. Roper Lindsay and will be covered in more detail by Mr. Thompson, who's been involved in that mapping exercise, in that ground truthing exercise. In response to comments from council witnesses querying the extent of the OSF activity area over the full station, the submitter is still considering its options in terms of that set of comments, that topic, if you like. However, it is intended that whatever form of zoning is supported by next Thursday, there is no change to the application of the provisions to the farm and vegetation management areas. So we have certainty in terms of that particular topic that Dr. Roper Lindsay in particular addresses today. And then the other point that's relevant to Dr. Roper Lindsay's evidence in particular is the changes to the golf activity area. The version of the structure plan appended to Mr. Ferguson's evidence in chief extended the golf activity area to the east over an area which in the submission version was proposed as OSF. This extension includes a portion of the fern boom, and the extension will be explained again by Mr. Thompson, who's involved in the golf course design in particular, as it relates to golf course design. As far as the effect of this extension of the golf activity area goes with respect to vegetation and biodiversity values, Dr. Roper Lindsay will confirm that the provisions for use of the land as a golf course would be more protective, and that grazing will no longer be allowed for, the stock will not be able to access the waterway, and the requirements to allow for natural revegetation in the golf course rough areas will apply, creating an additional benefit in terms of indigenous biodiversity that would not otherwise accrue. There is no indigenous vegetation identified of note in the Gulf area that could otherwise be adversely affected.
Losing your audience, Paul.
Sorry?
You're losing your audience.
Yeah, might be in the wrong hearing.
Yeah.
Have you had a bit of that?
A little
finger. Yeah. Then I move on to diversification. All won't repeat subsection 7. Mr. McRae produced extensive evidence relating to the history of the McRae family, farming and Glenview Station, and his own proposal was essentially a means of ensuring their ongoing stewardship may be continued and diversified in the future. The zone proposal represents an efficient use of the natural and physical resources by providing for a high quality residential and visitor environment with high residential, recreational and visitor amenity while protecting the openness, naturalness and rural amenity of the surrounding landscape. In terms of the ultimate test under Section 5, this rezoning proposal is not just about a rural development, it is about the holistic, sustainable management of an iconic high country station in a beautiful mountain setting overlooking Lake Wanaka through the development of regionally important tourism and recreation facilities. Just touching briefly on the campground and farm homestead activity areas. In terms of the differences in effect from the consented park and stay proposal compared to the current zoning proposal, I submit that the inclusion of the campground and farm homestead areas into the zone represent a logical and efficient rezoning of those areas to complement the land already considered appropriate for development through resource consent and diversification of the wider station farming activities. It would be a real opportunity missed for the community and the zone landowners, with the station landowners, that the provisions of the zone enabling these positive effects activities to occur could not be implemented in a restrictive rural zone applied across the land, which does not account for those unique consented activities already being developed and undertaken on the site, and the extensive restrictive covenanting of the land that has been established as part of that development. Council evidence made points with respect to control and certainty over the nature and scale of activities anticipated for the campground and farm homestead activity areas. However, it is noted that there were no concerns raised in respect of key effects such as landscape or ecological values. And the anticipated activities are described clearly in the proposed structure plan, and I've just cut and pasted the definitions of campground and farm homestead, so we've just got that for ease of reference to remind ourselves of the activities that are being contemplated for these areas. And to ensure appropriate control is maintained over the scale of such activities, the subsequent rules still require restricted discretionary consent, alongside additional rules restricting the scale of the activity. These controls, combined with confirmation as to acceptability of effects on landscape and ecological grounds, provide a very good justification for the proposed plan provisions over those areas, enabling appropriate diversification of use that will integrate well with the wider station. In conclusion, the proposed zone will allow for integrated development in a way that will maintain and enhance ecological, conservation, biodiversity and recreational values. It will enable development at a scale appropriate for the land and its values that will complement the ongoing diversification of the station and ultimately achieve sustainable management.
Any questions for Mr. Development?
No, I'd like to have a bit more time to have a think over it and refer any questions to next week.
Yes.
That's happened?
Yes, that's right.
In that case, we should hear from Mr. McRae.
Very good. All right.
My evidence in chief highlights the importance of allowing tourism-based business income models to support and enhance general farming and farming-related incomes. Our vision is to continue developing new and improved business models to seamlessly protect and enhance the natural values of Glenview Station and its surrounding landscapes. My evidence conveyed the core issue that Glenview Station loves farming, but we realised that the local and national perceptions of what the word environment means has now altered. Farming in Glenview Bay will be heavily scrutinised for its environmental impact in coming years. We would like to diversify into some sustainable tourism operations to help bolster the land's ability to assimilate a variety of appropriate land uses. This will also help deliver a strong environmental stance by lowering the stocking rate and its intensity in appropriate areas of land. In my evidence in chief in paragraphs 22 to 32 in particular, I have explained the methods employed on Glenview Station in the past years to move away from traditional high country farming methods and towards sustainable farming and land management in line with the concept of eco-consumerism. I wish to reiterate that whilst our passion to pursue an organic approach to farming, satisfies our environmental objectives and philosophically, it is difficult to implement this change across the farm in a profitable way, at least over the short term. Glendie Station has a very good relationship with other surrounding tourism business models, including the Parkins Bay Golf Course development. The Parkins Bay proposal was originally very important to my parents because as the concept was being developed, it enabled capital to be released and reinvested in the organic farming model beginning to be developed at the time. The family also saw the Parkins Bay proposal as an innovative way extension to our family's present activities and our past hard work. Throughout its local history, Glendie Station has always been as much about people and recreation as it's been about farming livestock. The location lends itself beautifully to be shared with people in a well-planned and environmentally effective way. We would like to be able to continue to work closely with the Parkins Bay Golf Course and related facilities in future to ensure any future-based business models work together seamlessly to avoid a disjointed landscape vision. I believe this is particularly critical given that Glendie Station is such an iconic landscape for both New Zealanders and international visitors. The Parkins Bay proposal is also admired because it provides comprehensive conservation and revegetation, which are very important components of overall sustainable land management. It is very important for my family to be able to pass on the station's land and business models to our future generations through succession, and I believe tourism can help strengthen the family farm operation and farm family values of Glendie Station. I also hope that our business model will encourage and support other landowners to consider alternative farming methods and income sources which are driven by an objective of environmental sustainability. This, to me, is the driving passion behind why we want to continue succeeding in organic farming and why we want the Glendie proposal to proceed. As stated in my evidence in chief, we are pursuing this dream not because we ultimately need to, but because we want to. I consider that this proposal is giving me a greater ability to care for this wonderful property and a chance to build a bigger picture of eco-sustainability and diversify further as tourism's. Due to pressures of changing markets, it is important that our property continues to move towards more sustainable farming tourism and land use management practices. Organic farming linked with Parkins Bay proposal was our initial solution for achieving this goal, and now it is apparent that tourism and hospitality at an appropriate scale can further complement that. But what I believe and what truly motivates us has been the need to change of the need for a change of direction to retrieve a truly sustainable use of high country land.
Thank you, Mr. McCray.
Good afternoon, Mr. McCray. You've certainly got significant, what would you call it, much more of a very important, iconic situation that you're in. I just would like to clarify yours and your family's role going forward in the future management of the Glendie Bay activities, plural, in a general way. Are you anticipating having a sort of sublease or subcontract arrangement so that the golf course will be managed by a different entity from the campground, for example?
There's nothing like that on the table at present. Just be clear on that.
There's no hidden agenda. It really goes to ultimately, in terms of the decision we make in looking at the different methods of achieving the objective of that is set for the zone or the area. Just how all of these different activities will be managed alongside each other. So I'm just interested in etiquette in a general sense, whether the Mapai family will continue to be very hands-on with all of that, or are you looking at having specialist managers for different parts?
Depending on what those parts become, we would stay connected, like Parkins Bay, for example. We're still connected to the not inside the development, but we know what's happening, and we support the development in its entirety on how it's moving forward and like what's happening. If anything changes towards the camping ground and these other parts that we're talking about, we would like to keep connected to that so we could control and help. I like that word, seamlessly, so that it doesn't become disjointed or piecemeal, and let the land definitely stay in our ownership. That makes it more clear. We would have control of those developments.
Well, without wanting to single out any particular thing, just because golf courses are a specialised sort of activity, who would you have running the whole golf course
We're not in charge of the golf course or have any operational input there.
And similarly, the campground is a separate entity. And
the camping ground, the current Glenview Bay camping ground, is completely owned by council. The land has nothing to do with us.
So that's not to do with you?
No.
Thank you. So just going back to this long journey that you've been through within the Environment Court, were you relying on your advisors regarding the extent to which mitigation became a part of the success of the FEMA, if you like? What I'm getting at here is where the evidence is that creating a zone is a more efficient and more effective way going forward of enabling a certain level of development to occur. So it's based on the Environment Court's decision a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the consent conditions are very specific in relation to height of the permitted residential dwellings, their appearance, access to them, the effects of the golf course, screening, the re-vegetation planting, provision of public walkways, all of that. I just would like to get a sense from you as to whether you were fully cognizant of what that would mean for you in trying to implement the consent. We seem to be in a situation now where the consent has been granted, but the message is it's too hard to implement.
That question is probably better put to Mr. Darby, who's
implementing
the golf course and the dwellings and the lakeshore thing.
That's why I asked Mr. McRae, you know, whether you were sort of involved or what level of...
Mr. Darby can answer that question, whereas I think Mr. McRae, because you're not involved in the golf course,
the
dwellings.
Yeah, that's more comfortable.
Well, it's helpful in any case, signal that's something that I'd like to understand from Mr. Darby or other witnesses next week.
That's good.
Because it is an unusual situation, and it does go to the heart of the appropriate method, and obviously Mr. Barr's report is talking about the fine level of detail that is in those consents. So.
Yep, no, that's good. I'll make sure we're prepared to help you with that.
Alright, so it's been a very long-winded way. Too well, Mr. Darby, thanks for that. So thank you, that's all I have.
What's that?
No, it's a question, George, yourself. There's a question put to the requirements a while ago was that I fully understand, well, I hope I fully understand your philosophy and where you come from. I asked them were they at all concerned about the shift from, because I get that farmers are custodians of the land, always have been, hopefully always will be, but that shift that we're having now from farming, traditional farming, to, and it's hinted at in the state of Galilee's evidence, to more commercial, more intensive farming, and the concern that we have. I mean, obviously that's a concern that you share, which is, it's been raised. And a lot of that is, I get that you're coming from it and, you know, providing for an intergenerational McCree involvement in the whole thing. But obviously we have to look at this in terms of, you may one day decide, you know what, I just want to go to PubMed and eat up and relax, that's good work. So that then opens somebody that possibly doesn't have the same philosophy. Is that a concern to you?
I think that might tie in with the first question that I was asked about the camping ground and about having control or staying involved in any future developments, whether it's tourism or farming or leases of land to different business models, which I've saved in my evidence. To my way of looking at it, the zone change would allow us more flexibility to be able to put good plans and structures forward to review without triggering extensive legal processes each time we try to do something that we believe will be beneficial to the environment or the surrounding landscape. Is that
you're doing the zones and divisions as opposed to...
Yeah, because I'm not an expert on the zone itself, from what I've read of it and where we want to go and why we support it is we do believe that it's a very diverse and unique piece of land where we sit, and all I know is that after farming it myself for 20 years, 15 years in the driver's seat, it is getting harder and harder with social media and technology in farming and people's, the word environment, like I stated in my evidence, is now just getting used to beat you around the ears with every now and then. We need to have some flexibility in the next 20 years inside the plan to be able to diverse our income streams to reach our ultimate goal of passing the land to the next generation without it being entirely around the farming model. So that's without intensifying the farm stocking wise to be able to achieve that goal. We have other mechanisms we can use. Does that make sense without me sort of trying to...
Well, again, what you're not trying to paraphrase, you don't want to put it, Olivia, think it, there's an irrigators on it, you'd rather put a golf course.
The golf course?
Is that an analogy that would work for you?
The golf course?
Like in terms of diversifying in terms of the golf course, in terms of diversifying in terms of pivot irrigators and in terms of the...
Yeah. The golf course, I could just stick to my evidence, that to me the golf course is one part of the whole big picture. The station's a big land base. There's, and I think 20 years is our vision of myself and Emily when we'll be in, hopefully in the driver's seat for a bit longer, have visions for it that we've all started to do, that we've met some hurdles and constraints, and in my evidence I've tried to state that we love farming the property and we want to keep farming the property, but we need just to have a structure in place to allow us to diversify into other areas we need to, which aren't there at present. And the Glenview Station zone, to me, on my brief knowledge of it, is a way of achieving that.
So in many respects, the zone will assist the stations in many places.
Yes.
Thank you.
One question, Lance. One impression I got from the site visit that we undertook is that the enlarged campground area is very much larger than I was anticipating. Not to put too fine a point on it, I looked up and down the road, but this is huge. And I wondered about the rationale, why so much land devoted to camp. Like, I know you get thousands of people in the council campground over Christmas to a year, but you could have fired a shotgun down the middle and you might have had an empty caravan or three, but there's nobody there at the moment.
No. I mean, without that being the camping ground, obviously not in our ownership, but from being a neighbour of the camping ground, I can say that during the months of November through till end of March, you'd had a lot more than a caravan shotgun.
Yeah, I know.
But then after that, what I have noticed is there is more and more interest in that camping ground and people staying there as the years go, and I just think it's going to become a very important part of the surrounding district in Wanaka. And a lot of people are going to want to come camp, and right through the years, just like the shoulder seasons in Wanaka now have moved to being far busier, people will want to come and camp as technology moves and bits and pieces. Does that answer the question?
Like
going in circles a wee bit.
And so that's all I had. Anything more? In that case, we should hear from Dr. Rosalind. Thank you, Mr. McRae.
My evidence focused on this. Oh, first of all, thank you very much for getting this award. It's your honour to go and see this. My evidence focused on the ecological aspects of the proposed land reservation zone. In particular, I consider the extent to which the revegetation strategy and provisions of the proposed road address potential effects on ecological values and management of impact, including mitigation. The land over which the zone is proposed has low ecological value due to a history of farming and recreation land use.
However, there are pockets of indigenous vegetation cover and small waterways which provide nodes suitable for revegetation, regeneration and enhancement of both existing values. The plan provisions incorporate the complex and detailed requirements of the Environment Court decision in relation to revegetation in a wider landscape context. The features of higher ecological value are protected within what are now termed farm and vegetation management areas, by waterway setbacks and development controls, and by use of activity areas which restrict the location of specific areas to areas of lower ecological value. This allows for an integrated approach to ecological management and biodiversity enhancement across the proposed zone. I note that in some cases, for example where the revegetation strategy would apply over what is now a rural zone, there is a stronger requirement for protection and enhancement than currently provided through the operative district plan and the proposed district plan. Over 22,000 plants have already been planted in the consented land area and intensive weed and pest control undertaken. These plants represent the first steps in active biodiversity enhancement on the site. In relation to the golf course crossing the Fern Zone, the Revegetation Strategy 2016 has a golf course revegetation objective, which provides for natural regeneration of the golf course rough areas supported by pest and weed control. This would apply to the proposed extension of the golf course across the Fern Burn. In this area, stock, which are allowed to graze there currently under the rural zone provisions, would be considered pests and should be excluded from the waterway area. Management under the golf course activity area and revegetation strategy regimes will enable regeneration and active management enhancement of the fern burn's ecological values. Currently, there is no indigenous vegetation of note in this area. So, for example, indigenous species could replace the exotic trees, such as willows and poplars, that currently grow there. In relation to extending the review vegetation strategy, I understand that Mr. Davis accepts that the revegetation strategy, as it applies to the consented activities and area and its extension to any new activities for which consent would be needed in the proposed extended R activity area, provides both a strategic framework and operational guidance for enhancing biodiversity values there. However, he seeks to extend the strategy across the whole zone, in particular to require a revegetation strategy to be prepared when a consent application is made within the camping and the farm homestead at the FH activity areas. The revegetation strategy of 2016 was drawn up to address very specific consented activities in areas with specific environmental values and management objectives. The areas over which C and FH activity area status is proposed are very different in character and purpose. As set out in my evidence in chief, activity areas GSFH and GSC have very low ecological values given their historic and existing land use. A range of possible activities are provided for within each of these activity areas through the proposed zone provisions, making it more difficult to prescribe revegetation for them in their entirety. Potential ecological effects on waterways are addressed through proposed zone provisions, which will protect the adjacent waterways through setbacks. The more detailed definition of planting areas and programming that were required for the consented development in the revegetation strategy are not required in terms of effects associated with FH, GSFH and GSC. Rules, that's 44.5.5 and 44.5.6, give council discretion over enhancement of indigenous biodiversity values and planting, through which benefits in respect of revegetation could be secured. I consider this as an appropriate way to address Mr. Davis's concerns. Finally, the farm and vegetation management area. There is some confusion about the rationale behind the naming and purpose of the farm and vegetation management area. The farm and vegetation management areas were initially identified by the Environment Court as areas that should be protected from development and actively managed. They are wetlands and gullies running along the southern edge of the development area and the moraine slope above Fernburn to the east. The court decision is not explicit on the matter, but the conditions explicitly require the areas to be fenced off and revegetated. The gully and wetland areas lie within Covenant Area G, and the moraine slope area sits partly in G and partly in Covenant Area F. The Environment Court conditions require indigenous revegetation and other activities to enhance biodiversity in these areas. The boundary of the moraine slope farm vegetation management area follows the top and bottom of the moraine slope, identifying an area that was suitable for indigenous vegetation, including totara, as specified by the Environment Court conditions.
Thank you, Dr. Rapalanzi. So what I've understood from the evidence is that the main ecological benefits, the difference in ecological benefits between the consented environment and the zone proposed is in the FHNC areas, is that right?
And in the OSF farms, the particularly in the moraine and the farm distribution.
And if you were to characterise the magnitude of those benefits compared to what's been consented, is it a slight betterment? Is it a substantial benefit or something in between?
I think it's moderate to high, yeah, because of the scale and the potential.
And particularly in terms of the FHNC areas, just because of the way your evidence worked, you're counting that enhancement as a positive effect because you don't think it's required as a mitigation of an adverse effect.
That's correct, yeah.
And when you say it's not as required as a mitigation of an adverse effect, it's not required to mitigate any adverse ecological effects that might result from it.
Yeah, I'm talking about ecological effects, yeah.
If we found that revegetation, while not mitigating an ecological effect, might still be necessary to mitigate other effects that the rezoning might give rise to, would it be correct for us to not then consider it as a net positive effect overall? So if it's required for mitigation, whether it's ecological or not, it's mitigation. How can it be a positive effect as well as mitigation? Might be an unfair question for you as an ecologist.
It's what I'd like to think about, but I'm rather reluctant to.
Well, as soon as I gave you the opportunity to slip out, the fake Galloway card is not in your head, so.
Oh! I don't know what the discussion yesterday was about positive ecological
as I'm getting into it, we actually have been quite clear on why you think it might be a positive. So it's a question really for you, I think, to say Galloway is it required for mitigation of any other effects? And if so, does that limit our ability to call it a positive effect when we're doing our overall balancing?
Yes, and I think that'll be an interesting conversation to have with Ms. Kluger in particular, in terms of any potential impact effects. Overall.
Just the complexity of ecological effects assessment, which is something I have spent some time looking at. Just identifying the value and what is an effect, and the scale of an effect, and the scale of the sort of mitigation you do, using mitigation as a generic word, and I prefer to use impact management. Mitigation is just one little bit.
I look forward to your submission to the next RMA review.
Thank
you. Reverend Lindsay, just following up on that, in terms of the quantification of the amount of ecological restoration in the consent conditions, how much of that, in your view, was required to mitigate any ecological effects, and how much was required to mitigate other effects?
In the development consent,
in the environmental consent.
I haven't tried to quantify that, and because partly, I did try to tease it out from my evidence. Because of the nature of the evidence that was given, the hearing, the environment court, the considerations of the Judge Jackson, his deliberations, his decision, and his conditions, mitigation and management of effects in the broadest sense, between using native vegetation to screen the building and the visitor accommodation became sort of interwoven with planting Karnica as part of the vegetation for ecological benefit, in addition to the wetlands and the shrublands and all the other things that's going on. So the answer is I haven't quantified it, because I think it got interwoven, and I don't know that it really matters from an ecological perspective.
But can I assume that there was a proportion of ecological mitigation that was for purposes other than mitigating ecological effects, even if you can't quantify it?
That's my understanding of my reading of the process.
Now, I want to ask you about an aspect of your evidence. Well, first of all, there's one point of clarification. That paragraph 50 D, your this is the revegetation strategy. Again, cross-eyed trying to find the gully. You show it to me on a plan where it is. Which gully you're talking about?
Okay, the gully. Sorry, there's an attachment to your legal.
My legal
submission. It's one of the.
Attachment B.
Sorry, thank you. So it was attached to Rebecca Galloway's legal submission. Attachment B, right at the bottom, just above the title, in fact.
parking space.
Yep.
There is this horizontal hatched area.
Yep.
And if you just go above the cave from Parkins, you
it says gully.
Gully.
Well, what is prize?
There are a lot of other gullies on the place, but that's the one.
But that's the one that's been
researched. That's research and part of the farm education area.
Yes, because I can remember when one of Mr. Darby's team showed us around the property. Uh-huh. We stopped at the very top of the residential area and looked down, yeah. Obviously out of our gully. So I'm just writing for my own benefit over the back of the residential area.
Yes, and there was it sort of extends along
the road. Next question about staging. Mm-hmm. You've said that this is not necessary. I've read the court's decision several times, and very interesting it is too, that one aspect of the court decision is that it records the stages you've identified at paragraph 57 as being based on your evidence of what was required. So the question is, what's changed? Like, I know from Mr. Darby's evidence, what's changed is he's found that it's very expensive. But in your professional opinion, given, as I say, it appears, well, at least the court thought it was your idea.
I'm afraid you haven't there, because I haven't read the decision recently enough to know, to realise that, and I'm trying to remember to go back to my position, which I do have here, what I said.
Was it in terms of growing times?
Is that growing?
Yes,
I think that was it. Sorry, excuse me. I think it was because it was about growing times. And so it wasn't to do the difference between the ecological aspect and the screening aspect. There was questions about how long would it take to grow Carnica tall enough to hide to screen vegetation, and I think I was asked to talk about that.
I believe you.
It wasn't ecological, and this is this ecological mitigation, visible earth mitigation, I think.
Well, but I suppose the question, whatever the rationale, suggesting it to the court, and so my question is, what's changed?
What's changed? Because at that time I was dealing with staging as an ecologist talking about how quickly trees grow. What I'm talking about now is staging to get biodiversity and ecological enhancement across the whole zone in this case and consented area. And that's not something you need to do associated with the staging of the house in the building.
So does that mean that I need to talk to Ms. Palooka about the relevance of staging to visual effects?
Yeah. And I think that's the separate issue.
Now, in terms of your paragraph 64, the conclusion that additional 6-8 home sites wouldn't necessitate further mitigation or environmental compensation. It seemed to me, reading the decision, that one of the key issues that the court focused on was not just the visual impact or the visibility of those houses, but also the extent of domestication that would come from bringing residential development to that hillside. And 8 further houses is about 20%, and a 20% increase. If there's a 20% increase in domestication, as opposed to whether or not the houses themselves are visible, again, talk to Ms. Bruegger about that.
Mm.
But in terms of the original rationale, is it your view that extent of increase in domestication doesn't warrant any additional mitigation?
it is. That's my view. I don't think it does. I think it's sufficient enhancement across the whole site.
Now, in terms of the expansion of the golf course across the Fernburn, are there any ecological values in the vegetation in or beside the Fernburn that we ought to be concerned about? Like, to be frank, when we look, they look mostly crack willow to us, which I'm not aware is high ecological values, but always remain to be surprised.
No, I mean, I haven't done an in-depth ecological survey. I have spent some time there just in the last few days, actually, just looking at this site. I agree, it appears to be a highly modified waterway with lots of willows and poplars, some few sort of briar plants, and a bit of natagaria close to the bank, but nothing of note. Within the waterway, there's no records of any found within the waterway itself.
So it wouldn't give you any qualm that the golf course designers decided that their latest plan is to have a hole crossing the stream and therefore a need to carve a gap in the vegetation.
I don't like the word carve a gap in the vegetation. Well, that implies it would, because there would, the 20 metres an
hour. I carefully considered use of chainsaws.
No, there would have to be ecological things taken. I mean, the actual protection of the waterway, but they've got the waterway setbacks, the earthworks, the marginal strip provisions, should all protect that immediate riparian edge and the waterway itself.
There would be issues with the clearance and making sure that was done properly, but that's a ways and means issue.
Yeah. And that's the thing, that the whole crossing, the railway needs to do.
But you wouldn't have any qualms about the loss of the vegetation if the removal were done properly?
If we're done properly. Choose a site. Take the willow, not the natagaria, if you've got a choice.
Yes, please. Dr. Rosa Lundy, I'd just like to clarify, when you, in your evidence, were talking about the trials that were done on vegetation for the purpose of testing the growth rates, can you just, based on what you've said about the staging and the fact that you were looking more at growth rates than on mitigation for visual criticism. What conclusion did you reach about the growth rates? I think you said the trial started in 2005 and that the vegetation had reached 3-4 metres, presumably by now, which is 12 years. So, what was the conclusion that you came to about that as a measure of successful or otherwise growth rate?
I must say I haven't been closely involved in monitoring and following this through. It was very much as it stated my evidence. I visited them when there were very small plants in the ground, and I sort of looked across to them a month ago, 2 months ago, and saw the height. I've talked with Hayley Farmer, the landscape architect, who has been monitoring and looking at them. I guess they haven't grown as quickly as would be required to meet some of the staging conditions. But that was one trial put in at one time. I think some lessons have been learned about planting methods, about weed control, and there's certainly more intensive irrigation now going into a lot of the areas. So it was a successful trial. The plants grew very quickly. It's kind of counter-to-gold throughout the Wanaka Basin. It's just showing, and I think it illustrates the need just to have the intensive management, which is already going in. You know, there's a waterway system through a lot of the plants.
And it's something we'll possibly need to explore with other witnesses as well. In paragraph 99, you referred to earthwork clearance for creating the tracts, and to the rules in 44.6.2 in relation to earthworks, being based largely on the underlying rural zoning rules, and that is consistent with what could be expected to occur in this area. But what I needed to explore with you is, was that based on the advice of others in relation to the rural zone provision? Or is that your understanding?
That was my talking with planners about the interpretation of them.
I was wondering about the, could call it a form of cumulative effect, that under the Environment Court decision, that has consented to a certain level of development, I think you're suggesting that on top of that there would be earthworks as permitted in the rural zone. So instead of confining the earthworks to what was approved as part of the Environment Court, there might be additional works. Is that
I understood that, going back to this, was Mr. Davies is concerned about earthworks, about the need to take indigenous vegetation into account in terms of public access, I believe. And my point was meant to be that, in fact, it partly wasn't possibly directed at me, in that the routes of the, excuse me, the lines of the public access tracks have already been determined by the Environment Court. So that was why it didn't seem relevant. And then he went on to talk about perhaps he was worried about the earthworks that will have to take place to build these tracks. And my assumption was that these would be limited to normal earthworks rules and are quite strict. So that it wasn't really relevant to this new zone because it was going to be under the rural. But that was talking with planners. Maybe a question for the planners, not me.
Yes, thank you. I'll seek some clarification about that. A lot of my questions did relate to the staging of revegetation and other mitigation, but you've already clarified that was in your comments about staging were in relation to the ecological mitigation. I don't think I have anything else.
Looking at the thing that you mentioned, that plants not growing as quickly as required, have you ever been to the Outer Hebrides?
I did my PhD on the Shetland Islands.
The Douglas fir, the height of that stag, would be 20 years old.
Yes.
Yes, I know.
I think ecologically.
All good, thank you. So I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thanks,
Sophie Galloway.
Thank you. Again, thank you for your
indulgence. Thank you, Dr. Brad Linden, Mr. Crown. We'll adjourn 5 minutes since we're running over time. Here, Mr. Todd.